Good morning, everybody. I hope you all made it well into the new year. When we last met, I completely forgot the season greetings. So, what is new? Anything you want to discuss? Any recent news or stories we should talk about?
Yeah, I think the most appealing topic these days is the discussion on the body scanner. So, concerning everybody's privacy who wants to enter a plane and fly from A to B. So the upcoming question is, does this really raise security, and how can we protect the privacy of one's person?
Okay, I think this is the most recent news. Just to give you a background, someone, let's call him a terrorist, tried to blow up a plane trying to land in the US. And maybe for some technical reasons, maybe for some, I would call it brave behavior of other people flying in the same plane, no real damage has been done, except to the person trying to blow up the plane. And for me, first, I would say this is a good story that it's not mainly the government protecting us, but it's us ourselves protecting us, because it was not a professional, it was just a layperson. They're doing the right thing within the plane. So I think the first story is, hey, civil society works because it's a civil society. We are helping each other. First story. Usually, this doesn't make it in the news. I think the people in the Netherlands are quite proud because the person comes from the Netherlands. But the main story mainly is forgotten. And now politicians talk about, hey, do we have some weaknesses? And the answer quite probably is, yes, we have. And the main weakness, from my point of view, is that the Secret Services didn't process the information they had in an appropriate way. So the main thing to do would be to fire the heads of the Secret Services, because the Secret Services didn't work using the information they had as they were expected to work. Never heard about that, probably. So what now starts is a discussion, should the Secret Services have more rights, get more data, etc., 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 it's the usual thing. And in the general public, the most impressive thing is these kinds of body scanners. In the particular case, it's really debatable whether a body scanner would have detected the explosives. There are some people who say yes, there are other people who say no. So somehow there we are in a limbo. Of course, it wouldn't make much sense introducing body scanners to detect things they, on principle, can't detect. To give you just a variant of the story, you did read in the newspapers that there was an attack on one person of the royal family in Saudi Arabia, and there the terrorists did get the explosives into its body and just ignited the explosives by, I think it was a Bluetooth device, something like that, a radio. What is absolutely sure is that body scanners won't detect explosives terrorists have within their body. So it's pretty clear that if you introduce body scanners, and of course you can't keep that secret, then terrorists know what to do. So From my point of view, what's happening? We should fire some people from the Secret Services. But instead of doing that, we are doing a discussion whether some new technical device, body scanners, could solve the problem. And now we are not discussing whether they could solve the problem. This would be a difficult discussion. And probably those people who want to introduce a body scanner would lose the discussion. What we now discuss is, hey, is it acceptable to introduce it? We are not discussing it, how much does it help? How much additional security or safety do we gain? Mainly we are discussing, hey, can we enhance the machines that no human being has a too detailed view on the body of another human being? So this is a discussion now taking place, and I would say it's a wrong discussion. It's simply missing the point. Okay, so this was one story, the most recent story. Any other things which are new, which you did read about?
I read a few days ago in the newspaper that this law against children pornography is so-called dead, but I'm not sure about that. If this will be the end of the discussion, I think in the next period of the voting period it will come again.
Probably, if it's election time, it will come again. Because some parties have the feeling it helps them in the elections. Nobody argues that it will help the children. So at the moment, no elections. So, okay. Okay. Other stories. Probably you did read, or I hope you read, a little bit about I think it was the 26th Chaos Computer meeting in Berlin. It started in Hamburg, but now it's Berlin. And what are the essential news from there? What is impressive? Or what is worth taking note of? I remember, I did read what was on Heise about it, and I remember two things, but maybe you start first.
They developed a practical attack against the GSM encryption, the encryption of the cell phone protocol.
And why is this particularly interesting?
Because now we can ensure that if we make a phone call and that it's not protected from.
So in the meantime, the story is mainly if you're using a cell phone, a determined attacker and even probably well-equipped neighbors could tap into your conversation. So this is the state of affairs at the moment. Some background information. Why is this kind of cryptography so weak? Is this an error, or is this by intention?
I would guess it is by intention, because if you have the rainbow tables that were essentially generated when doing the attack, you can decrypt the message. And I think it was guessed before or assumed before that Secret Services have the means to decrypt these messages. So I would assume that they intentionally made it relatively weak so that the Secret Services have a possibility to decrypt communication.
For me, it's mainly a combination of two things. One is what you just said. It was made, let's say, weak enough so that Secret Services could break it. Why that? Probably for reasons of export control. That is, this kind of technology is exported in all kinds of countries, even in failed states, failed countries, terrorist states. So the secret services of the good countries, whatever good country may mean, had the feeling they shouldn't export cryptography which is too strong. So I think this is one story. The second story is that the algorithms chosen, the cryptographic algorithms chosen, have not been published. So they try to be secret, they try to keep it secret for a long time. So maybe I should just go to the appropriate slide to make sure that we are talking about content of this kind of lecture. So this was, let's say, the slide giving you an overview what I'm going to talk about. That is, I start with the information theoretic, we go to cryptographically strong, this is what we today will do, and later on we'll talk about well-analyzed systems. And what they do is, they are using in an infrastructure algorithms they try to keep secret, which by implication means they can't be well analyzed, because either you keep it secret or you tell it to the good guys and they try to analyze it. And so what happened, and this is quite usual, that if more people look at an algorithm, and what happened is, of course, they didn't succeed in keeping it secret. So sooner or later, the algorithms got either published or reconstructed by people having some kind of curiosity, which is a good thing. So after the algorithm is somehow known, usually if more people look at it, usually some weakness is detected. This is absolutely usual. No surprise. So what do you do if you build an infrastructure? Hopefully, you first publish your algorithm. You have the good guys, as well as the bad guys, attack the algorithm for some while, and then you know roughly how much security the algorithm provides. Because usually, whenever you do some kind of analysis, what happens? Let's assume this is a security level. This is time. So this is, let's say, the security level the algorithm is designed to provide. Then what usually happens is, after some while, it's going to decrease. And then usually, for a long period of time, it's staying roughly at the same thing. It doesn't prevent that maybe later, again, it's decreased. But usually, most things happen early. And early means when more and more people get to learn the algorithm and have a closer look at it. And therefore, what you usually should do is say, hey, we are waiting at least so long, having here an estimation of how good the algorithm really is, and maybe here we are adapting some parameters of the algorithm, let's say a longer key length, more rounds, in case of a product cipher, things like that. And here we fix the crypto system. And only here we start implementing it in an infrastructure. Because what happens? When you have implemented it in an infrastructure, then it's really hard to change. Because at the moment, if you would say, hey, we want to upgrade to a better algorithm, what would this mean? Quite probably it would mean we throw away all the mobile phones we have, which is a splendid good idea. So if T-Mobile or Vodafone or another company or let's say the German government tells you, hey, boys and girls, we made a mistake, so please throw away your mobile phone, buy a new one. I would say everybody says, hooray, this is what I ever wanted. And okay, maybe we should combine it with another approach that to invest more money in industry, the German government should say, okay, we are providing to everyone a new mobile phone. And same story as with cars, you remember, maybe some kind of success in the short range. Okay, but hopefully you got the problem. Here you should start building the infrastructure. Never ever here. And this is what happened with the GSM network. And therefore, I will not talk in this lecture about secret algorithms. Okay, this by definition I couldn't do because if it's still a secret algorithm, I couldn't talk about it. Sure. And secondly, I will not talk about algorithms which are only analyzed by a small set of people. And small set of people, maybe 50 people. 50 is a large number if you really want to keep your algorithm secret. 50 people, usually in a democracy, in politics, it would mean if you tell your information to 50 people, then it's public. But 50 people is a small number of people if it's about cryptanalysis, because usually these 50 people, for example, are a group of people working for some governments, doing governmental crypto design and crypto analysis. So probably they are quite similar to each other. Not only that they all are wearing ties, but having a similar mindset. So usually a large number means not only a large number, but different people with different mindsets, with different backgrounds. Okay, so this was a GSM network. So what do you do? What is the conclusion for yourself? You shouldn't discuss real secrets on the phone. Is this new? No, not really. Because even if you're using the plain old telephony network, your fixed line, it can be tapped. And of course, even without breaking the crypto, mobile phones can be tapped. So please, if you really have to tell something in secret, you shouldn't use a standard telephone. Okay.
What I found even more interesting than the GSM hack was the attack they presented on quantum cryptographic key exchange, because we talked about it before and because I really find the method they use ingenious, because it can be applied to many attacks on crypto systems, like they also applied to IPv4 security. And it's basically not attacking the system, because the quantum cryptographic key exchange is somehow proved to be correct and unbreakable, but they attack the underlying implementation, and that's always kind of the weakness, and that I found very ingenious.
Yes. For me, in some sense, it wasn't a surprise, because it was pretty clear that that kind of attack would happen. I just tell you my mindset. I read papers about quantum cryptography since 1984, so it's meantime 25 years. So it's nothing new. What is new is that in the meantime, people don't make a theory about it, but they really want to implement practical systems. And now, of course, not only the theory can be attacked. The theory in the meantime is quite stable, and I would say it's well worked out. But now you can attack the implementation. And why did I expect attacks on the implementation? Because What is quantum cryptography? Quantum cryptography, I just try to explain it in a few words, is that you send your information, your key. So first, it's not cryptography, it's key exchange. It's the exchange of symmetric keys. So first equate, quantum cryptography means exchange of symmetric keys or exchange of secrets. And the idea is, now we come to the meaning of quantum, that the information you transmit is encoded in, for example, single photons, such that if an enemy tries to measure it, he's going to destroy the information. So the recipient will detect someone did manipulate on the channel. So mainly, quantum cryptography is an assumption how good you can measure. And framed that way, it's a physical assumption. And I argued that, maybe I should go to the appropriate slide. So what did we argue? This has been my conclusions about physical security. It's really hard to validate. That is, whenever you can, you should avoid assumption about physical properties, because it's really hard to implement. So tamper-resistant casings, I did recommend not to use. And of course, I will not recommend using that kind of stuff for key exchange. Why should we? And by the way, if you want to exchange a key, how do you do it? Pretty simple. You take a device like this, 30 euros. If you try to buy quantum cryptographic equipment, it's not 30 euros, it's a few hundred thousands of euros. Of course, if I would be a company, I would be very happy to sell something to my customers at that price. And maybe if you think about the government or the management structure of a company, maybe a manager is willing to buy it in spite that he knows that it's completely garbage. At least the specialist in the department would know that, because it's not the weak point. It's trying to protect something which is easy, and trying, in addition, to protect it in the wrong way, which is stupid. But okay, you invest a lot of money just to show that you are security sensitive. So it's good for the image. Does this remind you to something we just discussed? Body scanner. Completely useless if the explosives are inside the body. A large investment. And showing that they try to do something. What they do is nonsense. But nevertheless, they consist they have done something. That's great. So from my point of view, quantum cryptography is a non-issue. It's trying to solve a problem which is not really a problem, and it's trying to solve it in the wrong way. So this is my conclusion. This is my opinion I have since many, many years. And this is one of the reasons I don't teach about it. Please keep in mind, there's an interesting theory. So if you are interested in theoretical papers about quantum states, entanglement, it's really nice. It's nice theory. But for practice, I would say it's just crap. Okay. Still things you want to discuss? Christmas time seems to be interesting for security, isn't it?
There was also an interesting talk about the security in the DECT phones. That's the phones for household, the wireless ones. And the talk about online banking in Great Britain. They got this new system where everyone gets I don't know, some kind of machine to validate this transaction, and it was shown that it also doesn't really work and is easy to tamper with.
Okay, the Great Britain story I didn't read, so if you want to explain it in more detail, maybe others didn't read it as well.
Yes, they they give out a machine to each one who want to online bank. It's and you put a card in it. I don't know which card it is. I think just the card to get money at your bank. And you type in the account number of yours and the one who want to get money and the money you want to exchange, and then it generates a number. I think 10 digits or so. And then you put that number on your online banking site.
Okay. I think this is not really new. In
yes.
some sense, I would say it's pretty old. There are some companies, I think, for example, RSA Data Security, selling tokens for login in computers, which essentially work the same way. You type in your identity, you type in day and time, and this device gives you a pseudo-random number. Depending on day and time, your identity, you type in as your password, and then it's validated on the other side. So mainly, it helps that if an attacker gets to know the password, you type in your number, then this is only valid for 2 minutes or so. Pretty much the same, I would argue. Okay. Concerning DECT telephones, same story as GSM, secret algorithm. I don't know whether with DECT the secret services did play any role. I never heard that secret services wanted to weaken the DECT standard, because DECT is usually between your handset and your base station at home, and then it goes in plain text over the line. So for secret services, just tapping the line, nothing has changed. But nevertheless, I would say just that it was a secret algorithm got them into trouble. Okay, still some stories? Okay, yes, so this would be the last point I wanted to mention. On Tuesday, 15th of December, we had this oral trial before the German Constitutional Court. The main discussion was, is just storing data a problem for people, or is it only the use of the stored data, which is a privacy problem? And I hope that the expert witnesses made clear that it's even the storage, because usually if you store data, you cannot really protect it. At least you can't protect it if it shall be accessible within minutes, which usually means that there's no person within the loop. If it shall be accessible within minutes, it's an automated process. So I hope that the judges will take that into consideration. What I did is I gave them one of my USB sticks as a present. And before giving it to the judges, I said, could you give me a glass of water? And I just did sink it into the glass of water, showing that it's waterproof. And I told them that quite probably it's even acid resistant. So probably you could eat it and recover your data after 2 or 3 days, which means that whenever with such a USB stick, you get close to the data you are interested in, you can make a copy and then bring it out, because even body scanners wouldn't detect the USB stick inside you. By the way, and this is what I told them as well, I was with my USB sticks in many high security areas. Why? What do people do? They are looking for metal. So, okay, if you are scanning my body, what do you expect? Of course, in your purse will be metal, all the coins. So it's no surprise if it beeps. Nobody ever looked into it because coins are expected there. So it's beeping. Nobody ever had a look in it and saw, hey, that's not only coins, there's a USB stick. Okay, so I hope that the judges get the feeling that if data are stored, then it's nearly impossible to protect it. And to make it even more concrete, they asked Mr. Kurt, which is head of the Regulierungsbehörde in German, which is in charge of developing a kind of security framework for the data retention area. And he was asked whether encryption was considered mandatory, encryption of the retained data. And he said, no. We tell them that it is a good idea to encrypt the data, but it's a decision of the company whether they do it. And of course, all the expert witnesses urged them to make this a mandatory feature. That is, whenever you retain data, you should encrypt it at the spot, at the very moment, before writing it to disk. And using asymmetric cryptography, you could make sure that only a very few people have the secret key to decrypt it. And so these people are in the loop if data, retained data, is to be used. What's the drawback of this approach, of the approach I just proposed? You have to have your people, which are in the loop, available 7 days a week, probably 24 hours a day. This is expensive, first thing. Second thing, this kind of encryption, decryption works fine if you are only interested in some records, and in some sense you already know in which records you are interested in, so you decrypt only those. If you want to do some kind of phishing expeditions, then the demand would be, hey, could you please decrypt all your data? And then, of course, encryption of the data is pretty useless if someone later on can come and say, hey, I have, please, all the data decrypted. So it's hard to tell what the final ruling will be. My feeling is that I'm optimistic that the Federal Constitutional Court will say in each way where the German law goes beyond the EU directive, this is unconstitutional. I'm pretty sure they will tell this. Whether they will dare to say that the EU directive about data retention is unconstitutional, I don't know. There are some people who say, no, they won't say that, because this would cause some kind of constitutional crisis within Europe. Because if a nation state says, hey, we have a regulation at EU level, but in our country this is unconstitutional, then of course a problem. By the way, some smaller countries, at least one smaller country, already did that. And the proposal of some people were, hey, the German Constitutional Court could forward the problem to the European Court of Human Rights and giving them the German opinion, telling them, if we had to judge it within Germany, it would be unconstitutional. But since we don't want to cause a crisis, constitutional crisis, we submit it to you for decision at the European level. So this was a proposal which was made. I don't know whether the judges will follow that proposal. And probably we'll hear about it in March or April, I assume. A last remark. During the oral trial, no politician was present who was in favor of data retention. And the judges criticized that. The statement was, we really regret that we couldn't find a single politician within this room arguing in favor of data retention. To say it in the language usually which is used, okay, those politicians are cowards. This is the most polite thing we can say. So if you don't know the English word covered, it's feigling in German. And I think this is pretty close to how I feel. I think there are some arguments that data retention can help in some situations. So those people can make in some sense their point. But nobody was there, even trying to do it. And okay, let's see. Okay, so this was what happened since we last met. Any additional things you want to discuss? Okay, then I want to redo the last slide of symmetric authentication systems. Because I think I argued for the last slide in the wrong way. And so in some sense, just erase what you have in your brain about this slide. Give me a second try, and maybe in the video you should erase it as well. So if you talk about limits, what is clear is, if we have a sigma bit MAC, then the error probability will be larger or equal than 2 to the minus sigma. Because whatever the distribution is, there's at least one value of the MAC which has a probability of being the correct Mach with a probability larger or equal than 2 to the minus sigma. That is, sigma bits Mach, you attack by just guessing the most probable Mach. And in the limiting case that all the Machs are equally likely, you really achieve this bound, that is, equality holds. If not all the Mach values are equally likely, there are Mach values which are even more likely than 2 to the minus sigma. Okay? So this was the first statement. The second statement is, if I have a sigma bit key, then again, the error probability is larger or equal to 2 to the minus sigma. Why? Okay, in this case, just guess the key. Guess the most likely key. Calculate the Mach accordingly, and you will have a probability of success of at least 2 to the minus sigma. It's still clear that for an error probability of 2 to the minus sigma, a sigma bit key is too short. Because if you are launching an observing attack, the attacker will see the plain text and the Mach, which is formed using the key. And this equation here eliminates many values of the key. That is, if you want to achieve that bound, you need more than sigma bit keys. And what you need is 2 sigma bit keys, because this equation here tells the attacker sigma key bits. And after that, we still have to have sigma secret key bits. So overall, we need 2 sigma long keys. For the second message, assuming the first message has been authenticated as just described using 2 sigma key bits, for the second message, it's enough to have sigma additional key bits. Because what happens if no modifying attack occurs? The attacker learns to know sigma key bits using that equation. You take sigma new bits. So now again, you have 2 sigma bits. And this is enough for the second message. If no modifying attack occurs, then you can recycle sigma bits, and taking additional sigma bits, you can authenticate the third message, and so on, and so forth. Of course, if you ever experience an authentication error, maybe it's a transmission error, maybe it's a modifying attack, then, of course, you can't recycle sigma bits. Then you have to start with 2 sigma bit long fresh keys. And so these are limits which tell us how much do we need. The scheme we had here, so for this simple code, it's optimal. applying that scheme later on, as we did on that slide, of course, yields lots of overhead. For each bit we want to transmit, we want to authenticate many bits for authentication, and correspondingly many qubits. So doing what I described here is expensive. And at the moment, what is a good code? It's not a code where we could prove optimality or something like that. A good code is a code of Wigman and Carter. We'll come to it in the exercises where we need not 2 sigma qubits, but 4, so twice as much as the bound we just discussed. And the key length growth in addition with the length of the message, but only logarithmically fast. This is in contrast to what we had here. Here, if we had more message bits, we just had a linear increase in the key length and in the amount of transmission. And with Wigman and Carter, this increase is not linear, but only logarithmically. And then the growth is much less dramatic as for the one-time pad. So please remember, one-time pad, key length, same length as message. For information theoretically secure authentication, you need less key than a linear key, a key of the same length as the message, assuming your messages are long. Because then neither 4 nor sigma is really a problem. The good thing then is the logarithm brings your key size down. Okay, this was what I wanted to say to that slide, and okay. Do you have any questions? I hope it was better or more clear than what I did before Christmas. Okay, then we should do the exercises. We had 2 exercises to do. So this was one of the exercises. In this exercise, I take up what many people feel, that if we are talking about symmetric authentication, you hash first your plaintext, and then you encrypt the hash. So this is a proposal most people come up with. And the question is this okay or is this crap? So what did you find out? So the procedure is clear. First you take your plaintext, you hash it, you get an hash value. Of course you are using a secure hash function, which is collision resistant. And now you encrypt the hash value. Is this, in general, a secure construction?
I think it's not a secure construction, because an attacker knows the message and he can generate also the message to chest and use this message to chest to get the symmetric key.
Okay, that is, your statement is he knows the plain text, the attacker knows the plain text, he knows the hash function, so he can hash the plain text, he gets the hash value. And now if knowing the plain text and the ciphertext reveals the key, reveals the key is, for example, true if you are using the one-time pad, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. And how would the attacker now attack?
He would get the key and now tamper the message, generate a new digest, and encrypt this digest with the key.
Okay. Okay. So clear to everyone why this doesn't work? Okay. So hopefully you never ever in your life reinvent it and put it to practical use. In practice, people do something which is pretty close. They take, again, a hash function and a symmetric key. So far, same thing as just discussed. But they don't use the symmetric key to encrypt the hash value, but they are hashing the symmetric key together with the plain text they want to authenticate. And for example, this is widely done in the transport layer security protocol. So the idea is you hash key and plain text, and the resulting hash value is your symmetric authentication code. So the question is this a good idea? And more precisely, what kind of properties of the hash function do you need for this being a good idea? Just to remind you, what is a collision-resistant hash function? A collision-resistant hash function is a function where given the hash value, you are not able to reconstruct another value which hashes to the same hash value. So maybe I should make a drawing that if you have a hash function, you apply it to X and you get, let's say, a value Y, then it shall be difficult to construct a value Z such that Z hashes to Y as well. With X not equal to Z. So this is the usual definition of collision-resistant hash function. Now the question is, hey, is this enough for the TLS protocol to work? And of course, for psychological reasons, if I'm asking the question this way, the answer is no, it's not enough. But okay, what's the argument?
I think it's really important that the hash function value tells us nothing about the input. Because if you have Y, you should not be able to get the X worth to that Y.
Okay. That is Let's assume H is a really good function. Then we could construct for the TLS construction really weak function such that where do we have colored chalk? We haven't. Okay, then I have to do it in white. We could just say that if this is a hash value, we just make the hash value slightly longer by just saying we append, let's say, parts of X, let's say first 80 bits. This stays as collision resistant as it was before. Let's assume here we have then Z, first 80 bits. Equally hard to get a collision. But this modified hash function tells you, let's assume the first 80 bits of the argument here as well. And now if you put your key in front, you get to learn 80 bits of the key. Maybe this is a whole key, maybe this is a part of the key. In any case, it's no good idea. So it comes down to what you required, that the argument we need is that we say, hey, this hash value that is the result of the hash function doesn't give us any useful information about the argument. And this, of course, would be a violation, because this gives us, of course, useful information if it gives us particular bits. In practice, of course, it can be much more subtle than just adding 80 bits of plain text. So the TLS construction, the transport layer security construction, makes a much stronger assumption about hash functions than what is usual in cryptography. And I would argue this is always a risky thing. To the best, of course, of our knowing, the hash functions which I invite use today hopefully have that property, that the hash value doesn't tell us anything about the argument. But this is not part of the original definition. And therefore, I would argue this is a design error of a protocol. Okay. Part B clear? Or do you have any questions? Okay. Now, as you know me, usually I'm interested in public policies. And what I was really happy to notice, that secret services, which usually are really hesitating giving good encryption systems to the general public. So, for example, Zentralstelle für das Chiffrierwesen in Germany is not allowed to publish anything about encryption. It's top secret what they do. But they had the feeling, hey, about hash functions, we can publish. And I cite here the first publication, scientific publication in the area of cryptography of the Bundesamt für Sicherheit in der Informationstechnik, which was a successor of the Zentralstelle für das Chiffrierwesen, of Mr. Dobertin, and he published about hash functions. Because his bosses, the heads of the secret services, had the feeling, hey, hash functions, that's about authentication. It's not about secrecy. So they may publish. We don't want to break the authentication of the bad guys. We only want to know their secrets. So this is the official policy. And now, of course, I'm interested, is this policy really implemented by allowing publication of hash functions? So the question is, if you have a hash function with that kind of property that it's working for TLS, can you, in a very easy way, use that hash function to construct an encryption system which is as secure as the hash function? Of course, for psychological reasons, if I'm asking the question like this, the answer has to be yes, you can, which makes me smile about the Secret Services. So how would you do it? How would you use a hash function for encrypting messages? Any idea? What is missing with the hash function? A hash function has no inverse function, right? So for decryption, usually you would use the inverse encryption function. And this doesn't exist, which may be the reason that the Secret Services thought it cannot be used for decryption, but it can. How would you do it? If you pass the mic over there, then he has a chance to give what he says to the record.
So if this hash function is collision resistant, I think you could build a reverse function by just say, if I get for every value I hash another value and only that value maps to one value, you can also reverse that. And so we have an encryption.
Please repeat, I'm not sure whether...
Okay. In this example, you just wrote on the blackboard. You get a value for x, and it's y, and in this hash function, it is described the value y is the only... different.
So maybe first, just to make it again simpler, so
yeah.
This is what we are talking about, right?
So yes.
Maybe. Okay.
So you know that the hash value y could only possibly be hashed from the value x, right?
Yes, but assuming you are the recipient.
Yes.
I'm the sender, so I know x.
Yes.
I'm sending you y.
Yes. So I have to know that the hash function maps x to y, yes.
Yes. So if you would be able to guess x, you could verify, right?
Yes.
Because you get to know y. But of course, if you know nothing about x, and if x has a lot of entropy, then getting to know y, assuming the hash function is really one way, is really collision resistant, doesn't help you. But the main point to make is, and I think this is a good starting point, if for some reason or another you get to know x, you can guess x, you are able to verify. Okay? So could we, starting with that idea, construct a procedure which helps us to build an encryption system?
If X is short enough, you can try out all possible X's,
okay. So
and then you can compare the output of the hash function with the Y you know, And so you get X.
Okay. So let's take that to the extreme. Let's assume X is 1 bit.
Yes.
Then, okay. We start with 0. So let's assume we are getting Y1. No, Y0 should be consistent. And then we know, so this is Y1. So if you take it to single bits, it would be very easy. I send this or that, and you as a recipient try out both values, you check which is the right value, and that's fine. What's the problem with this construction? Everybody can do that, right?
Yes.
But now please keep in mind, what do we have? We have, hopefully, exchange a symmetric key. So maybe, if I want to send something to you, I should use a key we share, and all the rest of the group doesn't know. How could I use that?
You can put the key afterwards, the X, or afterwards the 0 or the 1.
Yes. So one way to do it is hashing the key and 0, giving Y0, and hashing the key and 1, giving Y1, right? Now, assuming the key is long enough, it's secret, the intended recipient can do the test, but all others can't. Okay, still this is not really usable. Why not? Because in the beginning you don't know which is which. But if you would just use that for transmitting a message, there are only two possibilities. Whether you code your 0 as Y0 or Y1. So if you do it so simple, then it could be broken by just, let's say, frequency analysis of zeros and ones, things like that. Okay? So still we need a slight enhancement. How would you do that? What would you do? What's the problem? The problem is here that this is secure for the first bit. But if bits repeat, it gets insecure. So repeating the input to the hash function, how would you prevent that? How do you guarantee uniqueness of your plain text? How would you do that?
You can use the key once. You have a long key, and you can use for the...
I could use a different key value each time. Yes, perfect. But in some sense, it's slightly expensive because now I have or I need a long key. And if I have a long key, I would just use the one-time pad, right? It's already invented. Already the criminals know it. Okay, so let's assume the key is we have at our discretion is relatively short compared to the length of the message. Because only in this case we have any need to invent something. So what would we do? What do?
Encrypt more than 1 bit.
Okay, so the first thing is we could go from 1 bit to some bits. What's the price we pay? Okay, we have to try out all possible values. So maybe trying out 16 bits would be okay, because it's 2 to the power of 16 tries. Maybe minus 1, if you're sure. Maybe you could go even to 24 bits, but probably for 32 or even 48, it wouldn't be an efficient procedure. So, okay, it helps a little bit, but it's not really helping a lot. So, still we need an additional idea. So what do you do to make sure that a message value never repeats? What do you do? It's a standard technique in networking. If you want to enforce that the value doesn't repeat, what do you do? You add a sequence number, right? A count or something like that. So, same probably we should do here. So, maybe we modify it a little bit. Maybe we have a zero and we have a counter. And now we have Y0, Y1, and it's changing in each step because just the count of the sequence numbers is incremented. And now if you have a counter, let's say, of, what shall I say, 64 bits, or 128. So it's easy to make sure that this is not going to repeat. And now we have it. We need a key, let's say 80 bits, or maybe 100 bits. And we can encrypt really long messages. By the way, if the sender and the recipient might get out of sync, what do? You could just send the value of the counter in clear. It can be public information. So your message format might be that you just add the counter. And now it's very robust, very stable, very easy. So if you have a good hash function, and if the secret services of the world want to have good hash functions being secure for TLS security, then you have good secrecy, good confidentiality. For me as a citizen, I would say this is good news, and I enjoy that. And with regard to public policy, this is something secret services should know. So in some sense, either you want to have an all-powerful secret service, even being able to play around with authentication as well, or secrecy cannot be really prevented. This is my conclusion. And therefore, I would argue having good encryption, both for confidentiality and for authentication, in the long run, will help the civil society more than the criminals. And as a last remark towards the trial before the German Constitutional Court and data retention, I tried to explain them that terrorists, if they want to communicate, have no need to use the internet or telephony. If small groups of terrorists want to communicate, they will use spread spectrum radio. Radio techniques known from the military, where you spread the power of your communication over a very large range of the spectrum randomly. The recipient knows that. He knows this random parameter. He can, let's say, focus the power again and receive the message. And someone not knowing how the frequency is spread does not even get to know that the message has been transmitted. That is, the technical basis is there, the military has the equipment, And it's pretty clear, if the military worldwide has the equipment, then terrorists will be able to get it, because they have money. They are relatively small groups. That is, the argument you hear that we need data retention to fight terrorists, I would just say it's ridiculous. Terrorists can avoid being trapped. The civil society, okay, it can't. So it's completely stupid. Okay, so you see, I'm really interested in checking whether public policies you hear can really be implemented, if they are really consistent. Because often in life, I don't know whether it's better to do it that way or that way. There are, of course, maybe compromises between, let's say, surveillance to trace and trap criminals and privacy to protect the good citizens. And of course, you can debate that endlessly. And there's not a unique answer which is right. But whenever people make up policies they can't implement, which are self-contradictory, then it gets ridiculous. And this is the point I want to make. And this is the point I made before the court. And some people from the Bundeskriminalamt probably didn't like me for those reasons. But okay, that's my job as a scientist, just to say what is true and give the arguments why it's true. Okay, so this was 3.11. Any questions? Okay, then let's see when we do the break. Okay, still we have a few minutes. Authentication codes. Did anybody do a small example? Or is it too trivial? What do you hopefully learn if you do a small example? Hopefully you learn that you shouldn't reuse your key, that it's in this small code such that this key value is changing all the time. Okay. So maybe this was part A. If you have any questions, then okay. Part B. Why is the authentication code information theoretically secure? How would you argue? I gave you a little argument. I think I started in the lecture, hey, assuming the attacker sees H0, then it can be two possible key values. And for these two key values, we have different max with respect to the other plaintext, to the T. But this gives you a first idea, but of course this is not a complete proof. So what would you have to do a complete proof? You would have to discuss all possibilities. So that the attacker sees H0 is one possibility, the other possibility is that he sees H1, T0, or T1. So you have to discuss all four possibilities. Okay, so it's not too many, so you can do it. But still, for a person with some kind of mathematical feeling, going through the same story four times is not really what is an elegant proof, right? So can you do better? Can you give a representation of this code where you can, using that better representation, give a much shorter proof why this code is good? Any idea? Okay, it's maybe given this representation, it's hard to see. If you look here, if you're taking the H, the MAC is the first bit, so HH00 here, and HH here, and 11 here. So the first key bit is the MAC in case an H is transmitted. If you look at the second key bit, this seems to be the MAC if you want to transmit a T. So if T and T here, so it's 0, okay. And T and T here, it's a 1, okay. So in some representation, this code tells you if you want to transmit an H, take the first bit as your authenticator. And if you want to transmit a T, take the second bit as the authenticator. Okay? Given this representation, do you have a shorter proof than discussing four cases why this is a secure code? How would you argue? Or maybe first I should remind you, what do you have to argue? Because what was our definition? So I think this was the definition of information theoretical security. So this is what you have to argue about. So how would you argue? Okay. Let's start with the attacker doesn't see anything. He just wants to authenticate a fake message or a fake bit. What are his or her probability of success? He has to guess the key bit. The key is randomly distributed, so a probability of 1/2, right? Okay. Second possibility, the attacker, the observing attacker, sees a key bit with the appropriate MAC. He wants to change the key bit. What's the problem for him? He knows one key bit, but to break the scheme, he has to guess the other key bit. And the key bits are not related. They are random key bits, mutually independent random key bits. So learning one key bit doesn't tell you anything about the other key bit. Okay, this is a proof. And in some sense, I would argue this is more fun than analyzing four possibilities. But, okay, if you want to be on the safe side, think about both proofs, and of course, it depends. Maybe discussing the four possibilities here is so close to the code that in some sense, this is a way to convince yourself. Maybe the more elegant proof, if you are more mathematically minded, is a way you remember how the code can be built. Okay, questions? Okay, did anybody do the parts C and D? Okay, then I would argue, do it if you like. There's not a simple, let's say, statement I can make which gives you the conclusion. You have really to try it yourself, whereas for the first two parts I could give you, let's say, the inside or the conclusion. E probably nobody did as well, right? Did anybody do F? Okay, if not, then probably I should take a note that here we did A and B, and that I give you this again for C until F. So maybe this is a reminder that you might have a look at it over the coming week, and if someone prepares something, let me do it next week. Okay, then we do the break now, 20 minutes, and then we continue. Okay, I think we should proceed. What I'm presenting to you now are the basics, the basic mathematical things for asymmetric cryptography. As we already showed, asymmetric cryptography cannot be information theoretically secure. Therefore, we need some kind of complex problems, difficult to solve problems, to base the security of our crypto systems upon. So, what you now get is a part of number theory, as it's called in mathematics. I'm not giving it to you as a kind of mathematical lecture, in the sense that I do everything as general as possible. I only will give you here an introduction to the parts of mathematics we really need. This means, if you want to have a more enjoyable mathematical lecture about the topic, maybe you go, in addition to going here and learning here, to Mrs. Baumann, who gives a mathematically oriented lecture about asymmetric cryptography and the mathematics of it. Here, I focus on what is really needed. And just a warning, maybe until here, you could mainly follow by just going to the lecture and without doing much at home. Here's now the point that if I'm talking about parts of mathematics, you don't know that it's absolutely necessary that you do the homework. If you don't start doing it now, and from this point on, probably in 2 weeks' time, you will be completely lost. Okay. Mathematical secrets. We need, in asymmetric cryptography, secrets where the operation of the holder of the key pair can be built on. That is, the holder of the key pair usually is the person to decrypt or the person to sign a message. And mathematical secrets often are prime numbers. And usually I call them P and Q. P for prime, and Q is the next character in the alphabet, P and Q. If we are looking at the difficulty of factoring, then the public part of the key pair often will be the product of the two prime numbers. It will be n. N equals p times q. And this public part of the key pair then has to be enough to know to encrypt the message. And then the person having the secret is able to decrypt. Or the public part of the key pair n is enough to test a signature, and then you need the prime numbers to sign, to form the signature. Of course, the prime numbers have to be big enough. And of course, what is a big number, what is a large number, depends on the equipment you have at your discretion. Probably, if the only equipment you have is your brain, then probably factoring a 100-bit number is not really enjoyable. If you have a personal computer at your discretion, factoring a 100-bit number, it's fun. You press some keys and it's done. Of course, if we are discussing security, we have to assume that the attacker has some computer at his or her discretion. So there's nothing like cryptography by fair means, as Messner and others defined fair means, that we are not using a lot of technology. You try to climb mountains or get to the North Pole or South Pole without much technology. In cryptography, you have to assume that your attacker will use technology, because you have not a common definition which is adhered to by all parties, what is fair. So at present, this means that the length L of the prime numbers shall be at least 500 bits. And for practical purposes, usually it's not longer than 2,000 bits. Of course, if you like, you can instruct your computer to generate much longer prime numbers, maybe 4,000, 8,000 bits. Can be done. And of course, security usually is increased. But often in practice, it doesn't make much sense to increase the security of cryptography if cryptography already is much more secure than your operating system. And therefore, usually we have not only a lower bound, but an upper bound as well, because longer keys then usually mean more computation, which boils down to longer waiting times, because you have to wait until the computation has been done. Or in case of mobile devices, it boils down to more consumption of power, which means your battery doesn't last as long. So this is a practical interval, which means then that n, the modulus, is in the range between 1,000 and 4,000 bit. If you are talking about theory, often in theory we will argue that this security parameter L is growing towards infinity. This is the theoretical approach. But in practice, of course, you can't do that. All numbers you have, all fixed numbers, are finite. Sometimes we want to have special properties of our prime numbers. One special property could be that P and Q are congruent to 3 mod 4. Is this notation, something is 3 mod 4, known to everybody, or should I just explain the semantics of congruent mod something? Or is this clear to everyone? Who has any questions in this regard? Then I should explain it. Okay, clear to everyone. That's perfect. That's nice. Okay, so from time to time we want not only to be P and Q being prime numbers, but we want them, for example, to be prime numbers congruent 3 mod 4. So this, later on, we will apply to the S square mod n generator, which is a pseudo-random number generator. We will apply it to GMR, which is a digital signature system. And we will also apply it to RSA. So this kind of mathematics with the prime factors applies to all these systems. I should mention that there are alternatives. There are crypto systems which are based on the so-called discrete logarithm. The discrete logarithm is based on number theory too, and is similarly well analyzed. But nevertheless, in this lecture, I mainly will focus on factoring-based crypto systems. I will, in the end, give you a few slides about discrete logarithm-based systems, but I won't go into the same depth with respect to those systems. Why? The only reason is lack of time. I have the feeling that usually in a lecture it's not so interesting to do more of the same. And more of the same means if it discrete logarithm is mainly the same mathematics, gives mainly the same security, then from my point of view it's just more of the same. So I have the feeling giving you other stuff is more interesting. But whenever someone comes up later on in your working life and wants to use systems based on discrete logarithm, they are not weaker, they are not worse than the systems based on factoring. So you may feel happy about that. So coming back to systems based on factoring, what are necessary things to have? The first thing, of course, is factoring should be difficult. If it's not difficult, then it's not asymmetric. If it's not difficult, then you can take just n, factor it. You know that the factorization of a number is unique, so if it has two factors, then its factoring delivers P and Q, so someone who is able to factor has the same secret as the person originally generating the key pair. So, the first assumption is factoring is difficult. And as we shall see, this is mainly an assumption. This is nothing we can prove at the moment. But nobody can prove something useful, neither about discrete logarithms nor anything else. So we take a usual assumption where many mathematicians worked to break it but didn't succeed. And they worked on that for centuries. Second necessary assumption is, of course, it has to be easy to generate prime numbers P and Q. Why has it to be easy? Because the person who wants to use and generate a key pair has to use the generate the prime numbers. Because we want that ordinary persons are able to generate key pairs. So for generating prime numbers, it should not be necessary to use the NSA's Super Trooper parallel computer, for example. Third, it has to be possible to do some operations on the message with the product N alone. And this operation you can only invert using P and Q. So there has to be a public operation based on N, which can only be inverted using the secret P and Q. So these are the necessary ingredients. And we will work towards these things, getting it more detailed, step by step. Factoring. First, it is clear that factoring is in non-deterministic polynomial time. NP, it's non-deterministic polynomial time. Why? If you have someone guessing you a factor, you can verify the guess in polynomial time. You just divide. And if it works, fine. And division is surely a polynomial time algorithm. So it's clear factoring is in NP. But at the moment, we haven't any proof that it's difficult. Any proof in a mathematical sense. I would argue that in some sense we have evidence that it's hard. But we have no proof. So how do we gain evidence? We give toys to mathematicians. They get supercomputers and they are allowed to play around with their toys. And play around means they try to factor. And as children play with matchbox cars, some mathematicians really enjoy factoring and playing around with their supercomputers. So this is a good thing. It keeps people happy and gives us some evidence and experience how good they can factor. The best factoring algorithms we know at the moment have a running time called often in the literature L of N. N is the number to be factored. L of N is the running time of the algorithm factoring N. And if you look here, you take E, this is 2.7 something, to the power of some constant C in the range of 1.9 times the cubic root of logarithm of N times logarithm of N squared. So, what do you learn? First, this mainly is the length of the number. And here we have even two times the logarithm. And the result we have to square. So, mainly, this is the third root of the length of the message, the length of the modulus, the length of L. And since we have here a root, not just the length, this is called sub-exponential. It's not growing exponentially fast, it's growing slower. But still it's growing faster than polynomial. So far, the theory, so far the general results at the moment. And if you want to have a practical analysis, you go through the web and you look up how large numbers people could factor. So how is this organized? Usually it's organized that some company who wants to demonstrate that factoring is difficult, usually these are companies who want to sell or promote asymmetric crypto systems based on the difficulty of factoring, they publish numbers and say, hey, if someone is going to factor it, that person gets a prize. Maybe it's a bottle of beer, maybe it's a bottle of champagne, maybe it's $1 million. It's always the same game. So if you are a large company, if you build your business on the security of the difficulty of factoring, maybe to offer some larger cash reward would be a splendid good idea. Because you demonstrate in public that the mathematicians, the mathematic folks at the moment can't do. Because if they could come up with the factors, they of course would claim the money. And of course they would claim their reputation being the first to do so. So even if mathematicians are completely ignorant of money, which some of them are, it's still a kind of reputation being the first. And usually if you really get money, then this gives you an opportunity to buy the next generation of your toy, the next generation of supercomputers. So what happens, or what happened? In 1999, people were able to factor 155 decimal digits numbers. Please take note, here we are talking about decimal digits. And here I talked about bits. And of course, you can transform one into the other by multiplying with the logarithm to base 2 of 10, right? 4 years later, people factored a 174 decimal digit number, and 2 years later, they factored a 200 digits number. I just looked up, this is a reference, whether they came up in the meantime with still a larger number factored, but I didn't find any. Of course, this is not a proof that it doesn't exist. I just couldn't find any. So these are the current records. And just to give you a feeling, 200 decimals, it's about 640 bits, something like that. So if you take the 500 bits times 2, 1,000 bits, then still you have some safety margin. How could life change? Life could change, or does change continuously, by more powerful computers getting available, progress in hardware. And here you have usually, let's say, an increase in power by a factor of 2 each year and a half. Sometimes each year, sometimes only each 2 years, on average somewhere each 18 months, a doubling of computing power for the same price. And of course, this doubling of computing power helps you. But if you look in the exercises, I have a corresponding exercise later on, you will see that algorithmic progress did do much more change than just increasing computing power. During the last 10 years, no algorithmic breakthroughs have been known, so mainly nothing changed. So these numbers at the moment seem to be stable, and they apply to numbers, factoring of numbers, which are relevant to cryptography. That is, you are choosing prime factors, P and Q, you multiply, and then someone tries to factor the product. I should mention that there are much faster algorithms than the general purpose factoring algorithm here, which factors numbers of a particular form. So, for example, this is a number which is pretty close to a power of 2. So sometimes, for very special numbers, it's easy to factor them. But if these numbers are very sparse, it doesn't matter for us. By the way, if you only want to factor a very few numbers, or show that you are able to factor very few numbers, then you can just start with the prime factors, then you don't have any need of factoring. So, what do? We assume that factoring is hard. And what does this mean? We, of course, cannot assume that the attacker cannot factor any number. Why? Because the attacker could just have generated this number by multiplying the prime factors. So an assumption that he cannot factor any number surely would be too strong. And of course, an assumption that he cannot factor all numbers would be too weak. Because if he could, let's say, factor half of the numbers, then this would be obviously an insecure system. And I even would argue if he could factor each thousandth number, it would be insecure. Because, let's say, if at the faculty we would generate key pairs for everyone, let's say we are 3,000 people, then quite probably three of the 3,000 key pairs could be broken by the attacker, which, from my point of view, would not really mean that we are using a secure system. So we need now some kind of definition. What it means that factoring is hard. And this is called the factoring assumption. And it reads like this: for all probabilistic polynomial time algorithms F. And F, as the character suggests, is a factoring algorithm, an algorithm trying to factor. And for all polynomials Q, there exists a capital L such that for all small l larger than capital L, it holds. That means it asymptotically holds that if P and Q are random prime numbers of length L and N is the product of two primes, then the probability W, for Wahrscheinlichkeit in German, the probability that the factoring algorithm taking N, the number to be factored, as parameter, delivers the prime factors, this probability is smaller or equal 1 divided by the polynomial Q at point L. Sloppily speaking, this means the probability that F truly factors decreases faster as 1 divided by any polynomial. So this is a factoring assumption. What's the intuition behind it? In some sense, we have to express something that asymptotically holds. That is, we need some parameter which is growing. And we want to show that if this parameter L is growing, then the probability that factoring happens gets smaller and smaller. And what does smaller mean? Smaller means it's getting at least as fast towards zero as 1 divided by any polynomial goes towards zero. So this is a formalism. This is the usual factoring assumption. I hope I could motivate it a little bit. I suggest that you read it carefully and think about it. Maybe you have questions, then we should discuss it. And probably this is a definition you should just learn by heart. Because usually then we need the negation of this definition. Later on in proofs about security. So in some sense, you really should know this definition. Any questions so far? Okay, I said this is an assumption. So the question is, how trustworthy is this assumption? And the answer is, I don't know. All I can say is, this is the best analyzed assumption which is available. So, in some sense, it's a pity. I can't tell you how good it is. I can only tell you, this is the best available. Of course, I should mention that large companies, banks, and others are betting their fortune on this assumption. Still, this is not a proof. Often I argue that larger corporations, governments are quite silly. So maybe in this case as well. So it's not a proof that they bet their fortune on it. But we haven't anything better. If we want to have asymmetric cryptography, of course we can use symmetric cryptography, and then things are much more secure and much more clear. But if you want to do asymmetric cryptography, this is the best you have at the moment. So this was, in some sense, the first part that I discussed. What does it mean? Factoring is difficult. Now we come to the second part, showing that generating P and Q is easy. So the first question is, are there enough prime numbers? Because if there only would be a limited number of prime numbers, maybe it could be that there are just not enough prime numbers for everybody. Then maybe only the good guys get the prime numbers and the others are forbidden to use them or something like that. Of course, would be ridiculous. So probably everybody in a math course did prove that there's an infinite number of prime numbers. Probably everybody did prove that in his or her life. But even this wouldn't be strong enough for practical use, because even if there's an infinite number of prime, you have the problem of finding prime numbers. Even if you know them, there's enough in supply. That's not enough, you have to find it. And therefore, it's good to know that if you just take random numbers, the probability that you, by chance, take a prime number is not too bad. If it would be too bad, it would just cost you too many tries. If you would need, let's say, 10 to the power of 10 tries, or 10 to the 100 tries, then you couldn't afford looking for a prime number. So if we take pi of x as a number of prime numbers smaller or equal than x, then we know if we divide pi of x by x, this is pretty close to 1 divided by logarithm of x. This is the prime number theorem. And you know that the logarithm is growing slowly, really slowly. And the inhabitants of Switzerland are really speaking fast compared to the slowness of growth of the logarithm. That is, even if we take ever larger numbers x, which probably we have to do because computing power increases, still our chances of choosing a prime number are realistic. And since this is the logarithm, it's growing so slowly, and computers got faster and faster, it's overcompensated by the computers getting faster. Practically, this means if you are going to the length L, then at least each Lth number on average is a prime number. So a procedure would work to generate primes that you just take a random number and test whether it's a prime number. Should work. Of course, you would speed up your procedure a little bit if you would not just choose a prime, if you would not just choose a random number, but maybe you are choosing an odd random number, because the even numbers, at least the larger ones, are not primes. So usually you fix your last bit, right? Speeds up your process by a factor of 2. Nice to have. And doesn't, by the way, not change the probability distribution in any way, because whenever you have a prime number, it will be odd if you're talking about larger numbers, right? Then, in addition, I should remark that each second prime number, roughly, is congruent 3 mod 4. That is, even if you have some additional requirements that our prime number is congruent 3 mod 4, still there are enough prime numbers having that probability or that property. Of course, if you want to generate a prime number which is congruent 3 mod 4, what do? You don't start with a random number. You probably first put the last and the second but last bit to be 1, and then take the rest of the bits randomly. And again, this speeds up your procedure without changing your distribution. Okay. So, what's the principle of search? You do a loop and you choose a random number, maybe 3 mod 4, and in any case, it should be 1 mod 2. And then you test whether your random number P is prime. If so, you take it. If not, you choose another random number. Nice. What we need now is a test for primality. I assumed here that we can test whether P is prime. How do you test that? Please don't come up and tell me, okay, we try to factor it. And if our factoring algorithm gives us the result, no factoring possible, then it's clear that now it's a prime number. Okay, splendid, good idea. Good in theory, bad in practice, for obvious reasons. So, we need another procedure. And what is taken in practice is a probabilistic primality test. What's a probabilistic test? A probabilistic test is a test where the test answer, the test result, is not absolutely true, but only very likely true. Are you willing to rely on that? It depends. Assume you are meeting another person, and that person tells you, I love you. Okay, you are somehow paranoid, maybe this is kind of trap, so what do you do? You say, hey, I want to check whether you really love me. So let's make some experience with each other, but still I'm skeptical. So you do that. After you know that person, let's say for 2 years, probably the other person asks you, hey, by the way, in the meantime, do you trust me? And then you tell her, until now, it's pretty clear that I could have trusted you. But this is only a limited experience, so I don't know. So I have to stay skeptical. And probably now the other person gets the feeling, okay, this guy is really paranoid. must be some crypto freak or something like that. And so what do I want to tell you? Usually I have the feeling that the test gives us absolute certainty. And of course, in some mathematical theories, this indeed is the case. And this is one reason why some people really love mathematics. Because with a finite number of steps, you really get a result which is valid. And they are happy about it. They have reason to be happy about it. But in real life, usually we are willing to base our decisions on test results which are only likely to be true, but not perfectly true. And to make a long story short, a probabilistic test is nothing different than what we do in real life. We have no absolute certainty, but we have, let's say, a very high probability that it's okay. So this is a probabilistic test. And the most famous one is called Rabin-Miller. And this test is most easily to state for the special case that the prime number is 3 mod 4. And the theory tells us that if P is a prime number, then for all A's not congruent 0 mod P, we will get, if we take A to the power of P minus 1 half, then we get either 1 or minus 1 mod P. So this is a theory. This is a theorem within the area of number theory. So it's pretty clear if P is a prime, you take some A's, you test this, you should end up with 1 or minus 1. Assuming your computer works fine. If P is not a prime, then, and here we need the 3 mod 4 to get an easy result, then we know that at least for 1/4 of all A's, we have that if we take A to this power of P minus 1/2, then we get 1 or minus 1 again, but only for 1/4, or at most for 1/4. Putting it the other way around, for 3/4, with more than 75% probability, we don't get 1 or minus 1 as a result. So, okay. And how do you do a primality test now? You take A's, which are not zero. Okay, not too difficult to check that it's not zero. You are calculating this, and you look whether it's 1 or minus 1 mod P. If so, P might be a prime number. If not, P definitely is not a prime number. So you start with 1a, you do it. If it's plus minus 1, what do? You repeat it. Let's say 30 times, 50 times. And now you know something about the probabilities. You can then calculate the probability that your test is misleading you still. Okay, if you're paranoid, then you do it 100 times. But please first calculate the probabilities, and maybe then you are saving energy. Probably we should frame that as green cryptography. And of course, if for any value of A, it's not 1 or minus 1, then you have a proof that P is not a prime number. So what is the outcome of this Rabin-Miller probabilistic primality test? The outcome is either this is not a prime number, and this particular A gives proof that it is not a prime number. Or, with overwhelming probability, this is a prime number. Not with certainty, but with really large probability. So, at what is the error probability? It's 1 divided by 4 to the power of m. Now, if you take m as, let's say, 50, then this is mainly 1 divided by 2 to the power of 100. And now, it's pretty clear that we are talking about probabilities which are good enough for practical purposes, I would assume. Okay. So, this was primality testing. Now we go into details. What algorithms are fast and how do we calculate? And what we do is we are calculating in Zn, that is in the ring of residues, or more precisely the ring of residue classes mod n. And often we write down these classes, these residue classes mod n, as 0 until n minus 1. That is, we take representatives of each class. It's pretty clear that addition of such classes is fast. We just take a representative of the two classes of each class. You add them, and this gives you a representative of the resulting class. Same for minus. You just subtract, and that's fine. Same for multiplication. You just multiply the representatives. Fine. So addition, subtracting, multiplication are fast algorithms. The first interesting question is, how about exponentiation? Is this fast? Or is it slow? Do you remember how you defined exponentiation at school? Probably you defined something a to the power of b equals a times a to the power of b minus 1, right? Something like that. And now if you take that definition to calculate it, then it's pretty clear that it's not fast enough. Because if you have some exponent, and you have a multiplication, to do a multiplication, linear in the size of your exponent, then it's too slow. It's an exponential number of steps. And having an exponential number of steps is not really fun. So, maybe for you it's a surprise, maybe you have the feeling, hey, this is cold coffee. Experimentation is fast. And I should sketch to you why it's fast, and the keywords are square and multiply. There's an efficient algorithm how you can exponentiate. And I describe that, this algorithm, to you by just giving you an example and describe how it works. Let's assume we want to calculate 7 to the power of 26. What we do is we bring 26 into a binary format. So hopefully I did this right. This is 2, 3, 4, so this is 16. 8 and 16. Okay, hopefully. Oh, let's see. This was 2, 4, okay, and 16. Did I do it wrong? No, no, it's okay. 2, 8, 10 together, 16, 26. Okay. How does square and multiply work? We take first 7, and to initialize it, 7 to the power of 1. And what we do is, we square it. So this is a squaring step here. So we square it. And squaring means mainly that we are appending to the exponent a 0, or shifting the exponent one step to the left. So if you want to go from 7 to the power of 1 to 7 to the power of binary 1, 0, just have to square. Squaring, this is just a multiplication, so it was fast. Then we see, is this the start of the exponent? And here we see, no, it's not. We want to have a 1 here. So to achieve that, we have to multiply. That is, we take this value, multiply with 7. And then we get 7 to the power of 1, 1. Okay, this is pretty, this part. Next step is squaring again. We shift the exponent one step to the left, or append a 0, by squaring. Now we look at these 3 digits, okay? In particular, we look at the last digit. Yes, it's a 0. Nice. No multiplication needed. So, and again, squaring, append a 0. Check whether there's a 0. No, there's a 1. Therefore, we need a multiplication with 7. Again, squaring. Check whether this 0 matches that value here. Yes, it matches. So we have it. So what does this square multiply algorithm achieve? It achieves that for each binary digit of your exponent, you do one squaring and possibly a multiplication. That is, for each digit of your exponent, you do at most 2 efficient operations, which is much better than if you would go for the recursive definition of exponentiation, which would cause you an exponential number of steps.
I have a question. You said for each digit in our exponent, we do at most 2 operations. So we would do at most... Okay, no, I lost myself. Okay, I answered the question to myself now.
Okay. No problem. I think this now is probably the most complicated part of the lecture, and so we need time. So whenever anybody has any questions, please interrupt. So what we have now is exponentiation is an efficient algorithm as well, or that there exists an efficient algorithm for exponentiation. Okay. In the exercises, you will get examples where you do that. Any questions so far? Okay. So here we had a notation Zn. This was a ring of residue classes mod n. And here we have Zn star, which is a subset of Zn, such that we are taking those elements of Zn which have a greatest common divisor with n of 1. That is, we take those elements within Zn which are coprime with n. And this then is a multiplicative group. So just to repeat, Zn was just the residue classes. And if you take as operations plus and multiplication, this is a ring. Zn star is a subset of Zn built in a way that it's now a multiplicative group. Here in Zn, you can't have, in general, a multiplicative group because there may be some elements which have no multiplicative inverse. And here in Zn star, the property that all the group elements A and N are coprime, this guarantees that you have a multiplicative inverse. And now the question is how do we calculate that in practice? Because we want to do cryptography, we want not to do only theory, and that there is a multiplicative inverse is not really interesting. We want to calculate the multiplicative inverse. Here, I give you the so-called extended Euclidean algorithm, which is a fast procedure for finding the multiplicative inverse of an element. The algorithm determines to A and N the values U and V with the property that A times U plus N times V equals 1. And if we determine the values in such a way, then it's pretty clear that U, this value here, is the multiplicative inverse of A. Because if you take this equation mod n, you can just ignore that. It's n times something, so it's mod n, it's 0. So you have something A times U is congruent to 1. And therefore, U is the multiplicative inverse of A. So I describe this extended Euclidean algorithm here using an example because it's the easiest way to describe it. So let's assume we want to calculate the multiplicative inverse of 3 mod 11. So what do? We start writing 11 as a product of 3 plus some remainder. In this case, it's 3 times 3, this is 9, plus 2. Then we shift the 3 here, so we are expressing this 3 as a product of the remainder, so something times 2, plus a new remainder. So we write here 3 is 1 times 2 plus 1. Now we see that here we got 1, which shows us that we are successful, that 3 mod 11 really has a multiplicative inverse. And now we will calculate it. And now we transform this equation a little bit. We are interested in a representation of the 1. So we keep the 1 and take 1 times 2 to the left side. So we keep 1 times 3 minus 1 times 2. So this is nothing but this kind of equation solved for the 1. And now we can replace and do the same with this equation. We can use this equation to express 2, which made it here. So 2 is 11 minus 3 times 3. So this is what we do. We replace this 2 by 11 minus 3 times 3. And now we just simplify the equation. We have 1 times 3. We have minus 3 times 3. So we have 4 times 3. And here we have minus 1 times 11, so minus 11. So this equation is a simplification of that one. Now you see, if you read this equation mod 11, this minus 11 can just be ignored. And what you have is 1 equals 4 times 3, congruent 11. In other words, 4 is the multiplicative inverse of 3. Okay, let's do it the easy way. 3 times 4 is 12, minus 11 is 1. Hooray! So, you see, this is a really fast procedure, because in each of these steps, the numbers get really shorter. And therefore, usually, this is an algorithm which only takes a logarithmic number of steps. So it's fast. And again, in the exercises, you will get examples, and usually you get more examples, and usually you gain confidence in your abilities if you do it yourself. Any questions so far? Okay. What we now are interested in is how many elements does Zn star have. First, we can just introduce a name for the number of elements. And the name is Euler's phi function. So Euler's phi function gives us the number of elements in Zn star. So we just define it. Phi of n is said to be the number of A's being elements of Zn such that the greatest common divisor of A and n is 1. Nice. Just to remind you that if you have an integer n not equal to 0, we have that the greatest common divisor of 0 and n is the positive n taken as a positive quantity. I should call it that way. So, having that, it's clear that we did define phi of n such that it gives us the number of elements of Zn star. So far clear, or any questions? Okay, let's now assume that we take n to be the product of two prime numbers. So P and Q are prime, and P is not equal to Q. Then we can calculate phi of n. And phi of n is P minus 1 times Q minus 1. And I should give you some argument why this is the case. If we take those numbers which have not a greatest common divisor of 1, which has a greatest common divisor not equal to 1, we have 0, because the greatest common divisor was the absolute value of n. We have p, 2p, and so on. The last multiple of p, which is smaller than n, is q minus 1 times p. And we have, of course, q, 2q, and so on, until p minus times q. So, how many values do we have which are elements in Zn but not in Zn star? We have the 0, so one number. We have the multiples of p, this is q minus 1. And we have the multiples of q, that is p minus 1. So if we add that up, we have p and q minus 2 plus 1, so minus 1. And we may add that up, because all the values we have here are different. So none of these values is 0, and these sequences and those sequences have no elements in common, because p and q are prime numbers. So we learned that the phi function of a number which has two prime factors is the product of both prime factors minus 1. Any questions? Okay. Now we want to have some relationship between the ring of residues mod n and the ring of residues mod p and mod q. So we want to see some relationship between calculations we do mod n and calculations we do mod p and q. And the Chinese remainder theory, sometimes abbreviated with CRA, gives us exactly that. It tells us that x is congruent y mod n exactly then if x is congruent my y mod p and x is congruent y mod q. Why that? What does it mean here? If we just take the definition of the congruence, then x congruent y mod n means n divides x minus 1. If you do it here, it means p divides x minus y. And here it means q divides x minus y. And now if you see that p and q are prime numbers, it's clear that if n divides, then each of the factor of n divides, so can go from left to right. And since it's two prime numbers, we can also go from right to left. You know, if p divides this and q divides this, then even the product of the two divides this. What we really need here is p not equal q, which is usual for the cryptosystems we will have. So what does the Chinese remainder theorem tell us? It tells us that we can do some calculations mod n, and we can do them mod p and q. Which means, let's assume we can't do some operation mod n. Assume there are some functions you can't do mod n. But if you can do them mod p and q, then you could choose or use the Chinese remainder theorem to do them mod p and q, and then put it together to do the corresponding thing mod n. So the idea which we will need in the following from time to time is, if doing it mod n directly is not possible, but if it's possible mod p and mod q, then someone who knows the prime factors of n can do it, because he can do it mod p and q, and then use the Chinese remainder theory to put it together. So he first calculates a value yp as function applied to x mod p, and a value yq as function f applied to x mod p. And put it together. Questions so far? Okay. How do we compose in practice? And here, please remember the extended Euclidean algorithm we had. So let's assume we did the calculation mod p and mod q, resulting in these values. Then, using these values we did determine by the extended Euclidean algorithm, we can calculate our overall result y by just taking the result mod q times u times p plus the result mod p times v times q. So these values we did determine once and for all if we fixed p and q. And then we can do calculations mod q, mod p, and just put it in. Why does this work? And I think this is easy to see using this table. So, look here. U times p, mod p is 0, and mod q is 1. Why is it 1? Because if you take this equation, u times p was 0, so v times q, congruent 1, so 1. V times q is mod q 0, and so it's u times p, it's 1. So and now we can take y as this product, and we can see that mod p, you can ignore that part, it's 0, so we remain that part, and mod q, the left part stays here, and the right part get 0. So you see, if you take this formula, mod p and q, it gives the results we expect. And the theorem, going back one step, tells us because it has the right value mod p and q, overall mod n, the value is right. So what do we have? If you use the extended Euclidean algorithm to determine this equation, you may choose the Chinese remainder theory to have a simple procedure to transform calculations you do mod q and mod p into a calculation mod n by just using this formula. And the correctness of the procedure I just described by this simple table. Any questions? This was an assumption. This is then usually something where we can only state at the moment we don't know that it's not possible to do it with the knowledge of n alone. But we can show that having the knowledge of p and q, we can do it. And this corresponds to my starting point that I said I want to be able to do something, decrypt a sign using p and q, and transform it then to something mod n, where mod n we can do some different stuff, for example, to encrypt and test. So what I want to show is that the Chinese Remainder Theorem gives us a relation between things we can do mod P and Q and those mod N. And later on we will see that some operations really can be done mod P and Q, but we don't know any procedure how they can be done mod N in one direction. In the other direction, usually they can be done. But maybe we will have examples later on, and now it's too theoretical or too remote what I just tried to explain. Yes, please. Yes, provided that you know that N is P times Q. Yes. That is, in some sense, who knows the secret key, P and Q, can do everything. And that the other way around, it doesn't work. This is something I can't prove. But we hope. Otherwise, no asymmetric crypto. Okay. Further questions? Okay, so see you next week.